So good evening, everybody. It's a lovely evening at the Abbey. And let's start with cultivating our motivation. So it's becoming apparent to the members of this community that the world is moving into a more disintegrative, degenerate stage with oil spills and countries going bankrupt and the climate changing so quickly. And so the degenerate times are upon us. And here we are, fortunate human beings with precious human rebirths who have met the Dharma. And not only have met the Dharma, but have felt very called in the heart to receive teachings, to explore during these times where there's a lot of fear and anxiety and greed running abound. And so let's make a deep commitment to ourselves and to each other and to the world that we will not squander this amazing opportunity that we have, having met the Dharma, to take the Buddha's teachings deeply into our minds and hearts, to practice sincerely, to cultivate all the good qualities that we in the world will need from us, and to abandon those negativities and mental habits that will get in the way of us being able to live totally engaged with love, compassion, wisdom in our hearts. They say during the degenerate times that the power of virtue increases exponentially and that all good deeds become more powerful. And so let's make a commitment to progress along the path as best and as quickly as we can, to cultivate all the qualities that an enlightened one that we will someday become, some life we will become as quickly as we can, so that when we meet whatever living being, whatever situation comes into our lives from now until the end of this life and all future lives, that we'll be able to meet them with open hearts, fortitude, patience, loving kindness, and all the wisdom that we need to benefit them most perfectly. So tonight, Venerable is away this week. She's in New York with Venerable Jigme and Venerable Chuni at the teachings of His Holiness. And so we're reviewing February 25th's teachings. We're on ultimate bodhicitta and mind training like rays of the sun. And I was very struck by the motivation that Venerable gave that night. I've been thinking about it for the past few days since I offered to do the review tonight. And what she said was that it's so important for us to be willing and open to understand the Dharma, to be willing to explore it, and to keep going even when it appears that we have absolutely no idea what is being taught and that we don't see the benefit there at the moment. To cultivate a kind of, she called it a patient acceptance without any mumbo-jumbo unrealistic expectations, which I've kind of translated in my own mind as expectations about getting it, getting the Dharma the first time around, the second time around, the third time around. Because the teachings that she's giving right now are very profound and very complex and very subtle. And so the tendency to become discouraged is, can arise. So she really encouraged us to just keep going, and that listening and contemplating the Dharma is a very powerful and humbling experience. And that if we keep our hearts open and we have the willingness to explore and don't have a lot of unrealistic expectations, that the more frequently that we hear them, whether it be the second time, the 10th time, the 20th time, we find that, and this is something that people have, that we've talked to have concurred, is that you will hear the teachings And you will hear something as if you've heard it for the first time, and it will go directly right into the mind and will be deeply understood. But it requires us to go with an open mind and to take the teachings to the cushion and to study and to contemplate them consistently and faithfully. And that day by day we generate bodhicitta, which is really the driving force on why we want to hear, think, and meditate on the Dharma in the first place. And to contemplate to whatever level we can the nature of reality, knowing by the sheer force of cause and effect that enlightenment will come, and that the teachings that we're receiving right now are crucial. The key to the freedom, key to enlightenment, is the wisdom realizing emptiness. And that hearing, thinking, and meditating on the Dharma is all about causality. It's all about creating causes for our enlightenment, for all of the good qualities to be cultivated to the perfection, all of the negative qualities being abandoned. That the universe is ruled by causes and conditions, and the Buddhist teachings are all about creating the causes and conditions for our own enlightenment. And that through a lot of patience and consistency, the teachings first start as not understanding them at all, and then slowly but surely, intellectually, we begin to understand them on a level that we can either ask questions about them, talk about them. And then over time, with a lot of fortitude and consistency to our practice, they become deeper into our minds, less intellectual, and more directly realized in our hearts. And this happens from the very simple teachings of precious human rebirth, which are profound, although they sound simple, all the way up to the four-point analysis. The Buddha has laid out the entire path, step by step. And so there we have in front of us all the causes and conditions for our own enlightenment in order to benefit others. And so we need to set our motivations clearly and sincerely to bring the Dharma to our lives as best as we can. And that slowly we build the capacity to understand the teachings, no matter how difficult they seem to be on the first go-around. So I was very struck by her motivation of just hanging in there and staying with it, even though we may not understand and that we may not know why we're hearing the teachings and why we're being given the teachings. So I reviewed the notes and the audio on the teachings of the February 25th. And taking Venerable's motivation to heart, I honestly had to accept the fact that I didn't understand almost all of what was taught that night, with the exception of some parts. And so not wanting to either confuse myself or mislead or teach things that aren't correct, I did extract from those teachings some things that I have some understanding of, and I put them together with some teachings that Venerable had given on emptiness a number of years ago at Dharma Friendship Foundation in Seattle, hoping that together they will be able to be helpful. I have found them helpful over time. And there are a lot about concerning how we misunderstand how things exist, how that causes suffering, how ignorance is the source of that suffering, and what conditionings or acquired views we actually acquire during our lives that really become obstacles to this wisdom realizing emptiness, and that that they really get us set in some very strong wrong views and mistaken understandings of how we exist and how the world exists. And there was a sentence in the teachings on the 25th that I have thought about and are sort of the driving force in the review tonight, is that Venerable said that in order to cultivate the wisdom realizing emptiness, we have to understand its opposite, which is the self-grasping ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence, of which I don't know about you, but my mind is totally clouded by. And so the wisdom realizing emptiness comes as a result of understanding the opposite of it, which is the self-grasping ignorance. So I've put some things together that I've been using to see how the self-grasping ignorance manifests, you know, in my life, in my mind, and some of the Dharma tools that have been helpful over the course of getting me to question how I'm perceiving things and if indeed they exist the way that I think. Because if we're holding on to, for example, Venerable gave this as an excellent example, which I found helpful, that there is a permanent partless, independent person, there is no way that you are going to ever be able to realize emptiness. So she gave an example of how we might hold on to this sense of some of ourselves or others being permanent, partless, and independent, which is not as subtle as, this is the lower school's concept of self that needs to be negated. The prasangika view is a much more level, a subtle level of self. It's the inherently existent self, which I'll share later on in the review. But Venerable said it would be helpful to look at this independent, partless, permanent self, which is the first concept to go, and a concept that we acquire a lot by our upbringing with having theistic religion, all of us being brought up in different types of theistic religions, that this particular concept of self becomes is very strong. And so we have to meditate on what really, what's possible to exist and what is it, and to keep our hearts and minds open when we start to do this exploration, because we're going to run up with some resistance. So the first thing is that she wanted to go through the definitions, and I have found over time that learning the definitions of certain concepts and terms in the Dharma is very helpful, because certain words and terms get used in the Dharma in different contexts, and they mean different things. So unless you understand what they mean in this context, they can get misunderstood, and then you get really, really confused. So Venerable went through the definitions of these, and then an example of how they play themselves out in our concept of self. So first she said that to understand permanence, it's something that's the idea of the self that doesn't change. From life to life or from birth until death, there's a self that does not change. That it's partless in the sense that the self is one, is sort of this unitary unit that can't be divided into parts, that it exists wholly unto itself and doesn't get divided into parts. And that it's independent in a sense that it doesn't depend on causes and conditions to exist. So it exists without having been produced by anything else, but yet it can produce other things without changing itself. It stays unchanged, although it can produce and create other things. So the most perfect example of this is in a lot of the theistic religions in the world. There is this concept of an absolute creator. And this creator falls into having these qualities of permanent, partless, and independent, in that the creator was never created. The creator creates but doesn't change in the process of creating other things. That it's partless, it's one monolithic unitary unit. And that it isn't touched or affected by anything else, so there are no causes and conditions that bring it into being, that keep it existing. And so this is the concept of Creator God. The other part that is permanent, partless, and independent that we also learn if we've been raised in a religious upbringing is the concept of soul or spirit. Once again, this is something that is ultimately the person. There's a body, there's a mind, but then there's this soul. It doesn't change from life to life, or if you believe in only one life, from the time you're born to the time you die, and by the time you go on to your creator, that soul stays the same, unchanging. It doesn't depend on causes and conditions. It can't be subdivided. It's exactly that unitary, one, monolithic one. So when His Holiness was asked about how people got this idea of this permanent, partless, independent self, he said, well, when you look at your body and you look at your mind, they're changing all the time. And here's this concept of something that doesn't change. So it's like, even though our mind and our bodies are changing all the time, there's something that always stays the same. So when you say, when I was a child, that I, there's some sense of I that's the same when I was a child, that is the same as who I am now. There's some part that didn't grow up, didn't grow older, that's still the same. And that, so that's how we get the idea of this permanent, partless, independent soul or spirit. The body and mind are superficial. They're changing. They're unreliable. But the soul and the spirit are very reliable. It's stable. It's absolute. It's independent. It's what you can rely on. And it's what gets liberated, what gets redeemed, what gets saved, what gets transcended, what goes to heaven, what, you know, joins with God and Jesus. It's permanent and it's blissful. So when in meditation you investigate by asking yourself, well, does the self exist like that? Am I permanent? Am I one unit? Am I partless? Do I come into existence without any causes and conditions? And when you ask yourself those questions, the answer to all of those is no, I'm not. And if you say yes, then you're saying that the I was separate from the body and mind. So you're thinking about this soul, you're thinking about this spirit, and that there's something that goes at the end of death, that goes from one body and mind, that kerplunks itself into another body and mind. And there's no Buddhist school that asserts this or agrees with this. And if you look sometimes, you can find that in your mind when you least expect it, that this idea of creator or soul arises. It comes right into the Dharma, certainly, at least for me it did. I mean, sometimes I find myself looking at Buddha nature like I used to look at a soul. Or the concept of a creator God gets sort of projected onto the Buddha. And I found this happen this past winter when I was thinking a lot about refuge, because I was going to be, you know, go for my ordination. I wanted to really deepen my refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I got to this point in thinking about it over the course of a few days, that I got really pissed off at the Buddha. Because I was reading the chapter in Geshe Zopa's book about refuge. And he said that the Buddha cannot save you. The Buddha cannot create the causes and conditions to free you from your suffering. And during those few days, I got to see how much I had projected the sense of God, the sense of Jesus, Savior, onto the Buddha. And that even though I was taking refuge and knowing I had to transform my mind, that I still, there was some part of me that believed that when push came to shove, that the Buddha would bail me out. He'd bail me out of my suffering. He'd help me. And so letting that go, knowing that, although he's omniscient, he cannot create the causes and conditions for my liberation and my enlightenment. He's given me all the tools with the Dharma. He had so much confidence in me that he said, I can't create the causes and conditions, but I will give you the Dharma to create your own causes and conditions. And I have also, because if he could have been able to save us, he would have, a long, long, long time ago. But he can't. The other thing that came apparent in my retreat this past winter is that the self, this partless, permanent, independent self, arises even when I'm creating virtue. When I have a virtuous state of mind, like when I'm thinking about taking refuge for the benefit, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, I'm going to become a Buddha and I'm going to benefit all sentient beings. So even the concept of this concrete I, this being that's permanent, that has a solidity to it, even in creating virtue, it arises in my mind. So what would happen if we were permanent, partless, and independent? Nothing. There's absolutely nothing that would happen. You couldn't change, you couldn't move, you couldn't grow, you couldn't talk, you couldn't walk, you couldn't create anything, you couldn't live, you couldn't breathe. You couldn't exist. There's no way. But for a lot of people, the idea of having a creator God and having a soul, that there's a lot of emotional appeal to that. to have a creator God that can save and reward, someone who can lead you out of suffering. There's a sense of, there can be a sense of security, there can be a sense of protection, of safety on some level. And the fact that there's, when the body's getting older and the mind's not doing really well, that there's a soul that goes beyond this life, that's not flawed, that's not falling apart, that doesn't get crazy, that doesn't get upset. And so there's something very attractive about these concepts in theistic religions that propel people to feel very identified with them. And so when you come to the Dharma, sometimes you've really got to watch and see how much that those concepts come with you. And with Buddhism, with the Dharma, it insists on you rationally justifying your position. If you think you exist like this, you have to logically reason and explain how that's possible. In a practical, logical sort of way. Not from belief, not from faith. Now, I did add a little piece here that wasn't part of Venerable's teachings, is that I've noticed that there's a lot of young people, 35 or younger, that come to the Dharma, that they were raised in non-religious households. You know, either their parents didn't have a practicing religion, they didn't go to church, or their parents let them decide what they were going to believe in. And so when they come to the Dharma, they don't have this baggage. If anything, they've got a particular form of skepticism, where it's hard to convince them that maybe the Buddha does exist, that rebirth and karma are, that they exist in the world. So I'm not quite sure where the permanent, partless, independent self in those that don't have, particularly in non-religious, how, you know, young people who don't have that, where that plays in. But it's something that I wanted to clarify, is that there's people of, there are young people in a younger generation that don't have a lot of the concepts about God, creator, and soul, and punishment, and heaven and hell, that sometimes give us a very strong sense of self and I. And so they don't bring that with them to the Dharma, which is a great, I think it's a great shortcut that they don't have to deal with for many, many years to dismantle that. And so then Venerable goes on to say that from the Prasangika point of view, which asserts that selflessness is the lack of inherent existence of persons, that this is the deepest mode of existence, and that it's at a much subtler level than the permanent, partless, independent self that needs to be negated. So for the Prasangika, the wisdom realizing emptiness, or the wisdom realizing selflessness, counteracts the ignorance that views the self as inherently existent, which means, and you're going to, when I give you the definition, it's going to sound a little bit like permanent, partless, and independent, with a crucial piece that's different. So in the Prasangika point of view, the self is identified as inherently existent, which means it's independent of causes for its existence. It's independent of conditions required to keep it in existence. It's whole and not divisible into parts on which the whole depends. And this is the crucial piece that the lower schools don't have when they identify the self or the object to be negated, is that it doesn't need a mind to recognize the basis of designation labeling. So this is the crucial, subtle point difference in the self that the Prasangikas say that we have to negate compared to the lower schools. So at this point, I wanted to sort of put in a few terms and concepts from the Prasangika dictionary, because this is where terms and concepts can get really confusing, because there's a lot of things with self and selflessness in existence. So I just wanted to just go over four of them that seem to be quite important at this juncture in the teachings. The first one is to reiterate the inherent existence, what that is defined as from the Prasangika view. It has a lot of synonyms: self-existence, true existence, existing from its own side, independently existing. This term refers to the wrong or mistaken view that something, and this includes person, self, and also all phenomena, exist totally independent of causes for their existence, conditions required to keep it in existence, that this self is whole and not divisible into parts on which the whole depends, and that this self is independent of any consciousness or mind needing to label it. The Prasangikas assert that there is nothing that exists in this way. In fact, they assert that everything is empty of or lacking inherent existence. Now, what we're dealing with is the mind of ignorance that asserts that everything exists in this way. So this is where we're trying to find out how we as individuals, how the ignorance manifests in our minds and how we see things and see ourselves and how we mistake how we exist. The next term that I have found helpful is to distinguish it is self. So when used in a word like myself, yourself, it refers to the conventionally existing person. Okay, so myself, yourself. It's the person who exists due to causes and conditions. So they've got mom and dad, grandma, grandpa, sperm and egg causes. Good karma. They've got conditions that keep them existing. Air, water, food. A body that's healthy, a heart that beats. Parts on which the whole depends, body parts, mind parts, and that this self exists depending upon a consciousness that recognizes it and labels it. So this is the conventionally existent person, conventionally existent phenomenon, self. Selflessness of persons. So there's the self that is the conventionally existent person. Then there's the self in selflessness. That self does not mean person. It means inherent or true existence. So selflessness means the lack of or emptiness of inherent existence. This is a really crucial piece. So there's the selflessness of persons, which is the emptiness of inherent existence of me and every other human being. And then there's the selflessness of phenomena, which is the lack of or the emptiness of inherent existence of things like cars, trees, anger, virtue, toys. So once again, to reiterate Venerable sentence, in order to cultivate the wisdom realizing emptiness, we have to understand its opposite, which is the self-grasping ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence. The self-grasping ignorance is a consciousness, a mind that misapprehends how the self and everything exist. So we get into trouble because the self-grasping ignorance loves to cling to the self, loves to cling to others, loves to cling to things and see them as concrete, existing from their own side, things to own, things to crave, things to cling, a self that needs to be protected, a self that needs to be defended. That there are things outside that are the cause of one's happiness and suffering. And especially when these objects and the self have the word I, my, or mine attached to them, then the self-grasping ignorance rises proudly and causes a whole bunch of trouble. Because what happens is when the self-grasping ignorance rises, because we feel misunderstanding how reality exists, the craving, the clinging, the grasping arises. From that, the afflictions. I need to defend, I need to protect, I need to grasp. There's an affliction that arises. As a result of the afflictions, we act, react. And so there's this cycle. Ignorance, afflictions, karma. And it just goes round and round and round. Now, a lot of the times self-grasping ignorance isn't manifest. We, for the most part, when, from the time we wake up in the morning to the time we go to bed at night, we do see things as inherently existent. We see them as permanent, existing from their own side with their own essence, the cause of our happiness and suffering. But a lot of the times we go through the day having pretty much a stable, happy, peaceful mind. We're not grasping at the objects. We're not grasping at the self. We're not grasping at somebody. We go through the day. We go to work. Fine. Lunch with the boss. Come home. Traffic's fine. Mind stable. Mind neutral. Not much going on. Still seeing things as inherently existent. But there's not no grasping, no clinging, no defending, no reacting. Come into the house. And the mail's on the counter. They go shuffling through the mail on the counter. And there's a letter in there from the IRS. There's an envelope. It's a rectangular shape. It has some ink on it. It's got a label on it, a name, your name. And inside is a piece of paper. All of this is just paper, ink. All these parts. But the mind sees IRS. And suddenly there's a feeling. And the feeling's not very comfortable. Not very easy. And then there's thoughts about that feeling. Then there's more feelings. And then soon you see the self-grasping ignorance arise and grasp, whether it's anger or anxiety or fear, worry, all around this piece of paper with a little bit of ink with a label saying, Joe Smith. And this happens over and over again through the course of the day. Sometimes the self-grasping ignorance manifests, sometimes it doesn't. These are the opportunities to see how we see the self. We see the I arise and how the self-grasping ignorance just gets us spinning. The afflictions arise, the anxiety arises, we react, call on the phone, get angry, yell, scream, get afraid, call a lawyer, I don't know. So it's helpful to take real examples from your own life where you have a strong sense of self or I and see if you're seeing reality correctly. So one of the things that I have found helpful recently is to look how we are raised culturally and socially and ethnically. How is the self built into a solid entity due to the identities that we gather about ourselves over the course of our life? The conditioning culturally, the conditioning socially, our ethnic backgrounds. How do we behave that in our culture is okay? What is not okay? How does our behavior and our manners, the way that we do things, our traditions, how do they give us a sense of self or grow that sense of self? How do we react when others behave out of the norm or culturally different? How does the sense of their self arise? How do we see them as inherently bad behaving, rude, unkept, ill-mannered? So a lot of how we're culturally and socially raised really affects how ignorance manifests in our own minds and how we play it out in our behavior and how we react to the world. How adaptable are we in unfamiliar environments? When we're taken out of our comfort zones, how does the sense of self, this inherently existent I, how does it arise? How does it feel? How does it feel when it's taken out of a place that's familiar? And manners and behavior, many countries, good and bad manners, I mean, they're so different. What's considered good behavior and appropriate manners and etiquette and protocol in this country doesn't work in another country and vice versa. So when I was recently in Taiwan, I found that one of my Dharma practices within the first few weeks was watching the sense of I arise as I saw the way that Taiwanese behave in their different types of manners, how they eat and walk and sleep and dress and things like that, and how the sense of I would get up to want to make an opinion about it. And at first, the culture shock was pretty strong for me because I'm American-born, I haven't traveled much, and so to go to Asia was very new for me, very unfamiliar. So there are a few things that happened that were really great Dharma practices, and after a while, I just got to laugh at myself. But the first few days, when we would all get in line, and I think it's partially because Taiwan's a rather small country with a very large population, that you would get jostled. I mean, I would get literally almost knocked out of my feet by a very small nun trying to get from the back of the line to the front of the line without a word like, excuse me, Amitofo. I mean, I would be like, excuse me? This went on for like days. And I would have, you know, a little bit of an opinion about it. And then finally, after a few weeks, I just left and just got out of the way before they needed to move to the front of the line. So I wouldn't, and I would just watch it and just smile. But my sense of appropriateness that came up, my sense of I, because I thought, you know, who the heck are you knocking me off my feet? And, you know, and for them, it was absolutely fine. You know, being in very crowded conditions, that might have been the way to get around. I mean, how many times have you stood in line at the movies or a sold-out concert and somebody butted in front of you? The same sense of I. You know, so we have differences but similarities on how that sense of I comes when you feel like you're being jostled or taken out of your place. The other thing that took some getting used to is opening doors. Like, nobody there, like, opens doors for people. And if you open the door for yourself, there's a good chance that somebody's going to get to the door before you do and close the door behind them before you get in. And once again, I saw my sense of, you know, this indignant, oh, you know, Americans are so friendly, we're so polite, and how dare you? It was really funny. So politeness, what is it anyway? I mean, it's just a label. And so after a while, it was fun because I just continued to just open the door for people and let people walk through before me and have doors closed in my face. I just laughed. Anyway, but the sense of I arising because they were different. Their manners and their behavior were different. And how the judgmental and the critical mind would rise up and flare up and I'd say, hello. Another example was, as soon as you woke up in the morning, we slept on these platforms, all lined up. We had 40 women in a dorm, and the first thing you did when you got up is you put your shoes on. And you kept them on. And when you went to the bathroom, you took them off and you put another kind of shoe on because you didn't go into the bathroom with those shoes on. And that when you went into the temple, on rare occasions you took your shoes off, but generally you kept your shoes off in the on the temple. So, you know, Sempke, who lives at the abbey where you never wear shoes in the house or in the meditation hall, was continually getting admonished for getting off of her platform, walking 5 feet without her shoes, or going into the bathroom with the wrong shoes, or taking her shoes off going into the temple. And, you know, once again, just watching, you know, the little contradictions going on in my mind and my sense of, well, that's not how we do it. And then after a while, this is the one that I never got used to. I got admonished till I think the day before I left about not putting my shoes on. So, never putting your outer robes, you never put them on facing a monastic of the opposite sex. You always put them on with your back turned to them. Things like belching, blowing your nose in the sink. All acceptable manners. It's fine. Belching in some countries is considered to be a compliment. If you're serving a good meal and somebody belches at the table, it's a compliment to the cook. As is slurping soup very, very loudly. It's a sign that the food is good. In Taiwan, when I've had my Tibetan robes on, I always have this arm covered. They don't have any skin exposed as far as their monastic robes. And so out of respect, Venerable suggested and said, you know, make sure that you wear a sweater when you're in your Tibetan robes. Don't leave your arm exposed. And that's very different as far as protocol, but that was something that you just did out of respect. And then here at the Abbey, we eat in silence. And there are people who come here at the Abbey, and that is just the most peculiar thing, is to not have livening conversation while you're eating a meal. So those are just some samples of how manners and behaviors in different parts of the world mean one thing to some people and don't mean the same thing to other people. And if manners and behaviors were inherently existent, then wherever you went in the world, all the manners and behaviors would be the same. But they're not, which just means that there is absolutely no intrinsic, inherent existence to manners or behaviors. And it was interesting to see how the critical and the judgmental mind of the self-grasping ignorance would just want to get into the act, just arise in those situations. So when you look at afflictions, you see how much they're connected to the self-grasping ignorance. It just feeds it. It just invites them. So what's wrong or right behavior or manners? How does the sense of I feel in a situation where you're expected to behave differently than you thought or differently than you were raised? These are opportunities to see the big I come out that wants to defend, wants to protect, wants to argue, wants to negotiate. And what was wonderful about being in Taiwan, I didn't have an opportunity. I couldn't do any of that. It wasn't allowed. It wasn't appropriate. You kept silent. So then you got to watch your mind very clearly because you weren't allowed to say, oh, excuse me, but we don't do it that way. You do it exactly the way that you're told. It was very freeing, actually. So in order to understand how things actually exist, these kind of everyday, you know, situations, when you're with family, you know, you're Italian and you're marrying into a Jewish family, there's all sorts of opportunities to watch the eye rise, the self-grasp, the ignorance grasp at what's right, what's appropriate. And how the self-grasping ignorance, how this clinging and wanting to defend, how much it causes our suffering. Now that's the whole point of trying to understand these philosophical schools, is to identify the self that causes so much suffering. And then the more we're able to identify it, and then to check in to see if it really does exist the way that it's appearing, that's where we start to dismantle and break down this. I mean, the ignorance has been in our minds since beginningless time. It's not going to go away in this life. But the kind of teachings that we're receiving about the philosophical tenets and the meanings of the Buddha's words all have to do with understanding what he meant when he taught the Dharma. And so the more that we get familiar with the way ignorance operates, the sooner we'll be able to identify and begin to dismantle it. And as a result of that, the sooner the wisdom realizing emptiness can be cultivated in a really authentic way. Because we'll understand what it is that we're trying to cultivate, because we're so clearly aware of what it is that isn't working. The opposite of that wisdom realizing emptiness. So those are just, I know that I'm ending a little bit early here, but I guess from the last thing that I really very much want to say is that that this part of the Buddha's teachings about emptiness and about identifying the object to be negated can be pretty intimidating, especially the first time around. And that this is where I begin to trust the qualities of my teacher, and that I begin to increase the trust that I have a qualified teachers in my life, and that if they say that the wisdom realizing emptiness is the key to liberation and enlightenment, and identifying the object to be negated this sense of this self that doesn't exist, that I believe does exist, that causes me so much heartache, if they believe that these teachings are worth every effort, every mental atom that I have in my mind to understand it, to contemplate it as much as I can, even though at times I'm intimidated by the teachings, that, like doing this for the review this week, I have a much better understanding of the different ways that the self arises, and that how it's very important to understand how the self is seen, and how the ignorance grasps, and how the wisdom realizing emptiness is the key. So by doing the review and studying the notes, it has increased my confidence in my understanding of these very profound but complicated teachings. And so I just want to encourage folks not to be discouraged and to really hang in there, as Venerable said, to keep an open mind, to keep a willingness and interest, and to be realistic about what your capacity is at this time, and then just to grow the capacity by continually studying, to re-listen to the teachings, to ask questions. The more you understand, the more the questions arise, which is very cool, because we have some qualified teachers that can give us some great answers. And so that is, and once again, to realize, to just say the sentence one more time, that Venerable said, and I put it in bold, is that in order to cultivate the wisdom realizing emptiness, we have to understand its opposite, which is the self-grasping ignorance that is the root of cyclic existence. And that's what we're doing, and that's what we're going to do, and that's what our teachers are inspiring us to do, and giving us the tools to understand how to do it. So let's dedicate all of our merit for planting some very strong imprints in our minds in regards to the wisdom realizing emptiness and identifying the self-grasping ignorance. And so may we be able to sometime, some life, have a direct realization of the wisdom realizing emptiness and to be able to eliminate ignorance at its root by doing so in order to attain a fully enlightened state to benefit all sentient beings so that we can also help them to identify the object to be negated and to understand how reality truly exists. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Flourish.